This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, a community in New Jersey charges environmental racism and a sludge processing plant is put on hold. We hear from listeners about ecotourism and overpopulation, and then a lot about rivers. Golden Prize winner Juan Pablo Orrego saves the Biobío River in Chile, a portrait of the Gila River in Arizona, and in the Earth calendar, shad migrate up the Hudson River of New York, but only when the forsythia bloom. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Three years ago, President Clinton signed an executive order addressing the issue of environmental justice, saying he wanted to, quote, ease the disproportionate burden of pollution in minority and low-income neighborhoods, unquote. Now, for the first time, that order has been used to scuttle plans for an individual project. It happened in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, where citizens opposed the construction of a sludge processing plant. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally visited the Ironbound section and has this report.
A popular Spanish-speaking radio station blares from a dress store on Ferry Street in the Ironbound. In this part of Newark, New Jersey, more people speak Spanish and Portuguese than English. It's a close-knit community with 19th-century architecture of row houses and small neighborhood stores. But nearby is heavy and often polluting industry. For many here, the proposal to build one more industrial plant came as the final straw.
We're on Avenue A in the Ironbound off of Vanderpool Avenue, and we're standing in front of Waste Management's transfer station, which was the proposed site for the sludge processing facility.
Tawana Stewart Griffin is the director of the Ironbound Committee Against Toxic Waste. Her group's work helped block construction of the sludge plant, which she says will cause environmental and health problems for the residents of the Ironbound.
The primary concern is that the sludge processing facility is one block from residents and four blocks of the South Street School. So they would truck it in, process it here where they would emit noxious odors, then from there truck it back through a residential area. And because of the cumulative effects of the overexposure to dioxin and mercury caused by the other facilities that already exist in the community could not stand to have another facility of this kind.
But the company which owns the site, now a waste transfer station, disputes these charges and wonder why, out of all the industrial sites in the Ironbound, they've been singled out. Biogro is a subsidiary of the giant waste treatment company WMX, formerly known as Waste Management Incorporated. They say they consulted with the community and have been working with them to create an acceptable proposal, and until recently they say they encountered no resistance. In fact, Biogro says their proposed plant will improve the neighborhood because it will replace the waste transfer station, a new sewer line will be installed, and truck traffic will actually decrease. Pam Racy is a spokesperson with Biogro. She admits the sludge may occasionally spread unpleasant odors through the surrounding area, but contends the plant will not be a hazard to the community.
We're talking about municipal sewage sludges that are safe to spread on farmland and grow crops. This is nothing close to a hazardous material. My second thought is, again, we are not adding a new waste processing facility. This facility is already functioning as a waste processing facility. It's just trading one use for another. I think, this is, to me, a good use of an urban property. You're not taking a new a site and adding it. You're not going out to a green site and making it to a waste processing facility. You're simply converting an existing waste facility to another one.
Tawana Stewart Griffin says she doesn't trust Biogro and does not want them to build in the Ironbound. She says they've been burned in the past when companies made promises that never came through. Ironbound more than fulfills the description laid out in an executive order signed by President Clinton in 1994. It called for special considerations when proposing potentially polluting sites in low-income and minority neighborhoods.
It's not whether or not Willa Breda has an environmentally sound project that they want to run here. It's that the community has suffered from a disproportionate share of, you know, environmental racism, if you want to call it, or environmental policies that will allow the community to, you know, suffer from a disproportionate share of these facilities. And enough is enough. The community is not going to stand for it. And the president's executive order basically, you know, gives us, you know, a leg to stand on.
The site of the proposed biogross sludge processing facility is only one of many industrial sites in the Ironbound. Anyone who's ever traveled through this part of northern New Jersey, right across from Manhattan, knows it's an area famous for pollution and industry. But this is also an area where thousands of families live and have lived for generations. Drew Krzyzewski has lived in the Ironbound for over seven decades. She started fighting against polluters 25 years ago and took me on a tour to show me why residents don't want an additional industrial site like the BioGrow facility. We first stopped at the Essex County Garbage Incinerator, just a few blocks from her house. The incinerator burns 70,000 tons of garbage a month and stands out prominently on the Newark skyline.
It's burning constantly, and what comes out of those stacks, we inhale it 24 hours a day. Now, we had the most highest mercury count here, and that doesn't leave you. Once you get mercury in your system, that doesn't go out. So there was no way of destroying it. But, I mean, we have to inhale not only the odor, not only the stack smoke and everything, plus what it's doing to our systems and our children and everything. So that's why we're upset about it.
Next stop was the Diamond Shamrock Superfund site located on the Passaic River. It's next to a wholesale produce market and a small cluster of homes.
1983. It was June, I think it was, when they discovered, the DEP discovered that right here on this site was the most dioxin found in the whole country. They manufactured Agent Orange back then. Now the buildings are all torn down, but they manufactured it since 1950 into the 60s, and then they left the building and went to Texas. Diamond Shamrock was a mother company. So when the company moved out, they left all the residue there. While they were there, they were dumping it in the river, they were dumping it under the railroad, they were dumping it all over, and the trucks coming back and forth were dragging it all through this neighborhood. So what happened, here, right here on this railroad track, they found 500 parts per billion. And the railroad cars would go right from here into these other companies and everything and carry all this dioxin with them.
Right on this railroad track we're saying.
Yeah, and they had like a snow fence here to stop the train. You know how long that lasted. The DEP comes down in white suits, hoods, hands covered, feet covered, all their bodies covered with a suit to protect them. The residents, the children, were running barefooted.
June Krzyzewski is one of the founding members of the Ironbound Committee Against Toxic Waste. Her Newark, New Jersey neighborhood is one of those strange places where a community thrives, even amid heavy industry. But she says this is her home, and it's worth fighting against an incinerator, Superfund site, or even a modern sludge processing facility. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Get in touch with us with questions or comment. Give us a call on our toll-free line. It's 1-888-49-GREEN, or reach us via email at green@wamc.org. Here's Environment Show Associate Producer Stephanie Goichman.
Every week we hear from our listeners. This week, listener Jeff Tishman of Del Mar, New York, comments on his concerns of the world's population.
Every time you talk about the ozone layer, every time you talk about the depletion of the Amazon rainforest, every time you talk about the depletion of, say, the salmon runs in the northwest, the pollution of our oceans, you have to talk about overpopulation, because That is the reason why it's all happening. We complain about the acid rain that's falling in the Northeast and that the acid rain is coming from the factories that are in the West. Well, the reason we have the factories in the West and the reason why they're producing the acid rain is because they're making products for the people that have been born and that are continuing to be born. And my major concern is that we don't address it enough.
And in response to our Talking Green segment on ecotourism, we received several comments. Here's one from Fred Breeden of Northampton, Massachusetts.
I find it hard to define tourism at all, for the most part, as ecological. Independent of what you end up doing in the community or area for, in which you intend to do your touring, touring by definition means travel. Travel means high and extensive use of petrochemicals, hardly ecological. It also means using excess money that we've extracted both from various peoples and from various environments that we, the West, the wealthy West, have to spend on doing such luxurious things as touring. It therefore would seem most obvious to me that if you really intend to care for a community and belief that is doing interesting things, as was mentioned, one project that was mentioned on the radio, that you would save your money and some of your money, give them half of what you would have spent on your tour, and stay at home and read a book.
If you have questions or concerns about the environment or one of our segments, give us a call on our toll-free number, 1-888-49-GREEN. You just might tune in to hear your comment next week on The Environment Show.
That was Environment Show Associate Producer Stephanie Goichman. The Biobío River runs from the Andes Mountains in Chile through lush rainforests before reaching the sea. The river has supported populations of indigenous people for hundreds and maybe even thousands of years. But now it's being tapped to feed Chile's growing need for electricity. One dam has already been built, and five more are planned. Juan Pablo Orrego is an activist from Chile and one of the winners of this year's Goldman Environmental Awards. He says these dams will block the natural flow of water through the Biobío, displace thousands of indigenous people, and even alter the atmosphere around the river. He spoke with Environment Show producer Thomas Lally.
The Upper Biobío is part of the ancestral territory of an indigenous people, the Pehuenche people. And what we are seeing is that we are risking right now the dismantling, the dismantling of this culture, literally. If the second dam is built, we are pretty sure that these people are going to disappear as a culture, at least, from the face of the earth. And they have been there for centuries. They are indigenous peoples of pre-Columbian ancestry. And we think that this is absolutely unacceptable. It's unbelievable in the 20th century, you know, going to the 21st century. This should not happen. And these people are somehow, they have the seeds in them. They could be masters in sustainable development. We talk so much about sustainable development, and these people really knew how to live there without degrading but one bit that fantastic ecosystem, you know, just using the products of the forest and of the river without degrading the environment. So we are destroying harmonious worlds, you know, to feed sick worlds like cities, you know, with this energy.
Is that the reason the dams are being built, is just to provide electricity?
Yes. The only purpose of these dams are energy, to produce energy. They are not multi-purpose. They are not for irrigation, just for energy production. Yes.
Now, a lot of people in this country will hear this and think, well, you know, why should I be concerned? What is my relationship to this river and to these people? How should they think? How should they answer that question?
Well, we have to start seeing the biosphere, the planet Earth, as one single organism, one single entity. I mean, that's the way it is. It's not a metaphor. I am a scientist, and this is a scientific truth. It's also beautiful and metaphorical, but it's a scientific truth. And when we destroy a river, and when we destroy large forests, we are somehow degrading the whole biosphere. We are degrading the capacities for self-sustenance of the whole biosphere. So really the Biobío, it's Chile's most important river, but it's also one of the most important rivers of the planet. So we have the really amazing species of flora and fauna that we haven't not even studied, you know, and the Biobío has not, as an ecosystem, has not been researched in depth. For example, lichens, fungus, mushrooms, even insects have never been studied in the Biobío. So we are risking the loss of things that we don't even know that they are there, you know, medicines, products, etc. So I think that people should start seeing this damages as a personal loss. This affects everybody, affects the whole of humanity, I think. And if, I mean, you know, the Biobío was becoming very famous in the whole world because it's so beautiful. It's such a beautiful, beautiful place. And sometimes, you know, people say, well, beauty is like a sentimentalism, as if it was wrong to defend beauty. And as an ecologist, you know, I'm saying that beauty is an indication of ecological harmony and richness. So it's no problem. On the contrary, we should defend beauty, you know, landscape and beauty.
So where are we now in the process? What is the outlook for the river?
Things are very difficult in Chile right now. You know, last week, finally, the country promulgated our first environmental legislation in our history, last week. So we are really behind in this sense. But as we all know very well, more than laws, what we need is the will, you know, the wisdom, the culture, the love to protect nature, which is in a way of protecting ourselves too, you see. So unfortunately, in Chile right now, there is the authorities and these entrepreneurs are totally mesmerized with money, really. They're very, I'm sorry to say this, but they're very greedy. So the only thing they think about is accelerated economic growth at any cost. So even with this environmental law, right now it's very difficult to defend an ecosystem, to defend a watershed, to defend a river. So if you think like logically, it would seem as if the second dam is also going to be built in the Biobío. But we are struggling. You know, it's a very, very popular cause in Chile. I'm sure that if there was some kind of consultation process in Chile, the Chilean people would say no to the damming of the Biobío.
1997 Goldman Environmental Award winner for South America, Juan Pablo Abrego, speaking with producer Thomas Lally. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Gregory McNamee is the author of A Desert Bestiary, Folklore, Literature, and Ecological Thought from the World's Dry Places. He presents a portrait of a green place on the Gila River in Arizona.
In the 2 decades I've lived in Arizona, I have become something of a collector of oases and rivers. This has been useful knowledge for survival, and acquiring it has led me into some unexpectedly beautiful corners of this dry state. One of the most beautiful no longer exists. It lay along the Gila River, just outside the small copper mining town of Winkelman, where a dense thicket of cottonwood, velvet ash, and willow trees crowded a low gray-brown sandstone cliff to shut out the sun. Between forest and cliff stood the narrow river, quiet after a run through a boulder-choked canyon just upstream. Within this sanctuary, it was possible to imagine that we lived in a different time and a greener place, and I spent many hours there on the way to the mountains, watching birds and working over notes for a book I was writing on the natural and human history of the Gila. At that narrow bend of the river lived an old Mexican-American woman, whose small frame house lay perhaps 15 yards from the stream, surrounded by mesquite trees in whose branches she had hung dozens of hummingbird feeders. Those feeders drew hundreds of hummingbirds from the surrounding desert, so many of them that approaching her house you would swear you were entering a great beehive filled with flashing creatures whose song went zun-zun, zun-zun. In this oasis, both natural and human-made, pride of ownership went foremost to the rainbow-hued Annas, Costas, Calliope, Broad-tailed, and Rufous hummingbirds that sheltered here, and then to the squadrons of tanagers, kingfishers, jays, merlins, and eagles who watched over the proceedings. An interloper, with no claim but of affection on the place, I suppose it met all my standards of paradise, with its cool water, its grasses, flowers, and trees, its abundant wildlife. I suspect it met the hummingbird's idea of paradise, too. Had we some way of asking, I would want to know for certain. But for this oasis, questions would come too late. All but dead after generations of damming and overuse, the Gila River danced a ghost dance and came to life with a vengeance for a few weeks in 1993, churning over the Coolidge Dam upstream, roaring through Winkleman, gnawing everything in its path. The woman's house and hummingbird feeders disappeared in a wall of water. So did most of the trees that line that small kink in the river's course. Where they once stood is now a wide, stony beach, and on that beach now loll herds of cattle, a desert river's worst enemy, and a reminder, if we needed one, that impermanence and destruction are our lot in the world. Where the old woman went, I do not know. I hope she has helped make another oasis somewhere in the desert to give weary travelers a little pleasure. The world she helped make before is gone. But not entirely, for just a couple of days ago I watched hummingbirds come to the Gila, not in phalanxes as before, but in twos and threes, to reclaim this slender ribbon of water. Harboring a few ghost dance sentiments of my own, I know that as long as those beautiful birds grace our rivers, there is hope for this dry corner of the world.
Gregory McNamee reading from his book, A Desert Bestiary, published by Johnson Books. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. In our continuing series on the Great American Harvest, we look at shad fishing in the Hudson River in New York. Shad are fish which spend most of their lives in the oceans, feeding on plankton. But each year at this time, they travel up rivers along the East Coast to spawn. Bob Gabrielson is a fisherman from Nyack, New York, and president of the New York State Commercial Fishermen's Association.
Well, we're just in the process now of getting ready to fish for shad, with the shad migration. We expect them to be coming up. And they're a little bit late this year, regardless that we did have a mild winter, but it's getting, and I don't know where the wind is getting over with here when we had ice on my boat yesterday, but when we have a northwest wind, and the shad should be coming this week or next week.
Gabrielson's been fishing for shad in the Hudson for 55 years and says flowers tell him when the migration begins.
Well, usually, I hate to say it, it's when I see the forsythia in my yard turning yellow and the flowers are out, my favorite slogan is the shad are in the river. And there are shad in the river right now. And that's the first sign that we always gone back to for years is when you see the forsythia flowers out here in Rockland County, the shad are in the river. And that gives us an indication they're coming. And then from then on, it's they increase and get more plentiful.
The most valuable product from shad is the roe, or the eggs. I think shad roe is the best food from fish nature has to offer. Gabrielson agrees and says the rest of the fish is pretty good, too.
The fish eggs inside of it, they call that shad roe. It's a big delicacy. It's found in the better restaurants in New York City. And then they take the roe out of the fish. They have the carcass of the fish. They take that and they call it, they bone it. They actually, first they do it, they fillet it like you'd fillet a normal fish. And then they put it, you've got to see them do this, they put it on a lazy Susan, spin it around. I think I make about 8 or 9 more cuts. And they remove all the hair bones out of it. And they refer to it as boning a shad.
Shad fishing on the Hudson and many other rivers is a dying profession. Today, most shad are fished in large quantities from the ocean, and that's put fishermen like Gabrielson out of business.
Well, I tell you, when I was a young man, there was 14 people fishing in Nyack. Now you're talking to them. The rivers, I'm telling you, I've never seen it so healthy and alive and so full of different animals than you can ever comprehend.
The irony of a river teeming with life while the fishing industry along it dies is not lost on Gabrielson. Maybe he just needs to plant more forsythia so more people know when to go fishing. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, pollutants from sources thousands of miles to the south are concentrating in the flesh of animals and fish in the Arctic. The eight circumpolar nations, together with the native Inuit peoples, are developing strategies to deal with the problem. The proposed treaty to ban chemical weapons requires poison gas supplies to be destroyed. Is the technology good enough to do it safely? We talk green about it. Singer-songwriter Robert Hoyt is not enthusiastic about where technology is taking us. In fact, he sings, "It's quitting time on the high-tech plantation." These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Anyone who has experienced the Arctic thinks of its vast scope, its seeming purity reflected in white snow and ice and on occasion brilliant sunshine. But the combination of airflows, weather, and temperature has made the Arctic the receiving ground for chemical pollution, which originates thousands of miles away. Deborah Dameron for Arctic Science Journeys reports from Fairbanks, Alaska.
Novelist Robert Service's gritty stories about the far north made places like Lake LaBarge in Canada's Yukon Territory famous. The stories reflected a time when the Arctic was a pristine land. Now scientists say the lake's polluted and its fish tainted. Mark Palmer is with the Canadian Department of Indian and Northern Affairs.
Sort of caught everyone in the Yukon off guard that all of a sudden there's this chemical toxaphene. Nobody knew what it was. Nobody, you know, was never used around that lake. Why is it in our fish? You know, everybody was sort of thinking Yukon was pristine and there's no problems here. And all of a sudden, wham, we got hit with this.
Toxaphene is a pesticide once used extensively on cotton and soybean crops in the United States. Banned since the 1970s, it's still commonly used in many developing countries. Although such countries are thousands of miles from the Arctic, toxaphene is making its way to the Arctic by hitchhiking aboard global air currents. Mark Palmer explains.
It's still being used in countries like Mexico and Russia. And it's really all organochlorines, especially toxaphene, are quite volatile. Where as soon as it warms up, they go into a vapor phase, and then they go around in the atmosphere, and when it'll attach itself to a raindrop or a snow particle, and when it cools down, it'll come back down on rain or snow and deposit onto the ground, and then in the summer it would heat up and come off again, and the grasshopper effect is what some people refer to it as, and it bounces around. Everything sort of bounces north and then gets stuck up here.
Toxaphene becomes trapped in the Arctic because it's too cold much of the year for evaporation to occur. As a result, the pesticide accumulates first in the lakes and later in the organs of fish. Indians and Eskimos consider eating fish kidneys and livers a delicacy, but health officials have warned against the practice.
The levels are so low, they don't mean a thing in the drinking water, but once they get to the fish, they're actually at, you know, quite high levels. As a result of this, Health Canada put an advisor out saying, based on the levels of toxaphene, don't consume the burbot liver and only eat limited quantities of lake trout flesh. And it was about 7 ounces a week.
Scientists say toxaphene and other chemicals pose a danger in only a few of the territory's thousands of lakes. To keep it that way, Mark Palmer says Arctic nations will have to lobby countries far from the Arctic to stop using dangerous chemicals. For Arctic Science Journeys, this is Deborah Damron reporting from Fairbanks, Alaska.
The eight nations which surround the Arctic Ocean and the native peoples known as Inuits who have lived in the Arctic since ancient times are developing strategies to protect their homelands. That was Barry Simon, Canadian ambassador for Circumpolar Affairs, telling her mother in their native Inuit language about international efforts to protect the North American environment. She describes how the Circumpolar effort has been organized.
The Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy, first of all, brings eight Arctic countries together, the United States, Canada, Russia, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Iceland, and Denmark, Greenland. And it was first initiated back in 1990-91 because there was a lot of concern over pollution that was being detected in the Arctic, particularly the toxic transboundary pollution that that isn't being manufactured in the Arctic but is coming through the various pathways like the air, the rivers, the ocean. And as a result of that, an agreement was signed by the eight Arctic countries, and it addresses several aspects of environmental issues. In particular, one of the most active areas at the moment is a working group that was created to address the transboundary pollution issue.
And we're now talking about PCBs and POPs and other toxic chemicals which are winding up in the Arctic atmosphere.
Yes, that's correct. Mercury, cadmium, you know, a lot of the different chemicals. And what scientists have found through the research and the work that is being done by this working group under the Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy is that these chemicals are accumulating in the Arctic region, and then they are then transferred to by the animals who eat the lichen and the moss, and then people that live in the north eat those animals. So this chemical, these toxic contaminants, are being found in humans.
In addition to the toxics, what are some of the other major environmental threats that the Arctic is now facing?
It has to do with large projects, like mega projects, that have not always been very sustainable for the Arctic or its peoples. And, you know, we're trying to introduce a new way of doing things in terms of development in the Arctic region, and that is that not only do you look at the environmental impact on the land, but you look at the impact in terms of the living resources and the people that live in the region.
Ambassador Simon says one of the real challenges in the Arctic is to provide both jobs in a market economy and to protect the natural resources that have sustained the Inuits who hunt and fish for their food.
One of the main priorities for Inuit, I think, all across the North, not just in the Canadian North, but in other parts of the circumpolar world, is that they want to make sure that we maintain the integrity of the environment, that we continue to safeguard the environment. But at the same time, they are looking more to see how, if development does take place, what role do they have in the whole area of sustainable development? How will it provide more jobs for the people in the north? Because right now, the young generation, which is probably the predominant population in the north, and is fair, you know, much more highly educated than let's say our ancestors were academically, are saying, well, we need jobs, we have to depend on a cash income, we can't be depending on welfare as a way of life. So they want to find a balance between being able to maintain your cultural identity as a people and be able to hunt and fish for your main food source.
Mary Simon is the ambassador for Circumpolar Affairs for the Canadian government and represents Canada on the Arctic Council. We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about chemical weapons and their destruction. And this is an issue which raises numerous environmental concerns, particularly as the Chemical Weapons Convention is being considered. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests today are Mark Evans. He's Chief of Operations and Program Manager for Chemical Demilitarization at the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. Craig Williams, he's co-founder of the Chemical Weapons Working Group in Kentucky. That's a coalition of citizens groups around the world working for safe and acceptable methods of chemical weapons disposal. And Mary Lib Hoinkes, who is general counsel of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in Washington. And I might say that Mary Lib was a former deputy assistant secretary of state for the environment. So Mary Lib, let's start with you. The treaty goes into effect whether the U.S. ratifies it or not.
Right.
What does it say about the destruction of chemical weapons?
It requires that any country that has chemical weapons, and I should add that we do in vast quantity, we have some 30,000 metric tons, Russia has some 40,000, must get rid of its chemical weapons, must destroy them within 10 years. I think what's very important for listeners to appreciate in terms of this treaty is that by law, the United States must get rid of practically all of its chemical weapons, whether any other country does or not, by the year 2004. And
now,
I'm sure that my colleagues on the radio station show here will be wanting to address the means by which we do
yes,
domestically.
Now, Mark, you're involved in that as part of chemical demilitarization. How's it going, and is this a process that's safe?
That's a great question, and the answer is it's going well. The DMIL program is in the, that's what we call it, the destruction effort, is in the stage where we are taking our technology and are prototyping it at a facility located in the South Pacific. And that facility has done what prototypes traditionally do, which is give us a lot of opportunities to learn ways to improve and to optimize performance. The facility in Utah, where about 44% of the United States stockpile is stored, has started operations and is demonstrating substantial improvements over that which we demonstrated in the Johnston Island facility. So I'd say we're on track to eliminating this threat once and for all.
Craig Williams, let me ask you, as a citizen watchdog group, are you satisfied that this process can go on in a way that's environmentally sound?
Well, not under the current choice of technology. It's an interesting question to ask Mr. Evans, how is it going, and for him to respond that it's going well. I think we need to define our terms. What we have here is a program that chose a technology back in 1982, that being incineration. The program is currently 13 years behind schedule, 700% over budget, has a history of releasing live chemical warfare agent into the atmosphere at both the prototype facility in the Pacific and what they're now calling the prototype facility in Utah, along with a myriad of other toxic material, much of which is of unknown public health impact. And I think that the fact that the Utah facility, supposedly having been modeled after the original prototype, was not going to have any forced shutdowns or these kinds of problems, and the fact that it's been forced to shut down at least six times since it began operations just last August speaks for itself.
Okay, so you're not happy about what's going on. Before we go to the phones, Mark, do you want to respond briefly to
that?
Yeah,
I sure would. A lot of what Mr. Williams likes to refer to in terms of schedules is typical of what prototypes do. And we need to recognize that a substantial portion of that could be repeated as we go to more experimental technologies introduced into more locations. I'd also note that it's been reported this multitude of toxins. 99.4% of what comes out the stack has been well characterized and the Environmental Protection Agency says it's cleaner than what's found in almost every urban area in the United States. So we need to try to put our terms into some points of reference.
Okay, so that will be an issue of continuing discussion. Mary Lib Poinkins, I'd like to ask you one question again before we go to the phones.
Yeah.
And that has to do with the requirements of destruction while we are doing it under a statute passed by the Congress. As you pointed out, the treaty will require everybody to get rid of their stuff.
Right.
Do signatories to the treaty, and not the United States, have the capacity to do this in an environmentally sound way? You mentioned Russia. You mentioned some other countries.
Well, the choice of how to destroy clearly is left up to the state party concern. But clearly it is in our interest to try to share technologies and to ensure that safe and sound methods are used. I just would impress, and it's interesting as we look at how we have different perspectives on this issue, that while we're considering how we will best do this domestically, this treaty is the only handle we have to ensuring that the rest of the world does any destruction at all. Right now there's no law against possessing or producing, in fact, chemical weapons. The only law, international law, that's on the books bans their use in war.
Okay. Let's go to the phones, and I see we have a call from Karen, who is from Oregon. Karen, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
I live in one of the stockpile communities near the Umatilla Army Depot, and I'm not convinced that the incineration program can be done safely. I'm very concerned with the record that they've had in operating the JCADS facility in the Pacific and with the problems that they've already had occurring in Utah.
Karen, how close are you to the facility that you described?
I live approximately 7 miles from the facility.
So this is a real concern as far as you're concerned?
This is a very big concern of mine, yes.
Craig, do you have any comments on the problems that Karen is facing?
Well, I think her concerns are well-founded. I think what we've got here is not a question or a debate on whether or not it's a good idea for the United States and for the world to rid themselves of chemical weapons. I think the issue here is how do you go about it in a way that meets the congressional mandate of offering maximum protection to the workers, the public, and to the environment. Clearly, incineration is not an environmentally sound or environmentally protective methodology. There are toxic materials, including low levels of agent, that come out of the stacks of these facilities on a chronic basis when they're operating perfectly, and on an increased basis when they're operating in an upset condition, which they seem to do a good portion of the time.
Do you have thoughts about other alternatives that might be available?
What we're looking for now is an honest comparative evaluation of alternatives that do not, as an intrinsic part of their process, emit toxic material into the environment as incineration does.
Okay.
We feel they're out there and that they can be demonstrated.
Karen, thanks for your call. Mark, you were challenged by Craig, who says that the incineration bent, which is the current approved method, is not the right one. How do you respond to that?
I would say that based on what we know today, if I have to pick a technology today, the answer is no. That the technologies have simply not been advanced and developed to a state where they're even at a comparable level of maturity to allow comparison with incineration. That's why, and I served as the primary author of the Army's report recommending research into neutralization-based alternatives to determine if, in fact, we could develop one in an effective manner that could serve to destroy the stockpile. But we need to recognize one other thing as well, that as these stockpiles sit, by their very nature, they're a very dangerous item. And that, as a dangerous item sits in storage, if a very unlikely event should act upon it, we could have a very serious problem. I pick a location like Anniston, where the population lives relatively close. Risk assessments, which have been validated by the National Research Council, show that the risk to the public is 700 times greater by doing nothing and waiting until this alternative can be developed than through disposing of it.
And
now,
again, we're talking in theoretical terms. What is this stuff? What are we talking about?
Well, what we're talking about is a series of chemicals. That we really need to demystify this. We're dealing with a series of organophosphate chemicals when it comes to nerve agents that act on the body's nervous system.
Known in the vernacular as poison gas.
Or nerve gas, yes.
Or nerve gas.
And there's also some parts of the United States stockpile which are what we'll call blister agents. That serve to cause something similar to chemical burns. That's what these things are. and they're contained in usually metal containers. Sometimes that container is called a projectile. Sometimes it's just a big tank, and sometimes it's a rocket. But that's actually what's there, and they're sitting in some cases in concrete-encased igloos, bunkers. And in some cases, they're even stored outside.
Okay, great. Well, let's go back to the phones, and another call from Oregon. Frank, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Yes, Frank Carcanrado, the mayor of Hermiston.
Mayor of Hermiston.
Right.
Isn't Hermiston a place where there's a facility being built or
yes,
planned?
Yes, the Umatilla Chemical Depot. I live in the same town as Karen Jones. We're on the opposite side of the fence. I do not agree with Craig Williams, and I do not agree with Karen Jones.
Okay,
incineration is the only proven technology to date to destroy the M-55 rockets. The other technologies could maybe handle the agent, but they can't handle the other parts of the rocket because one day of storage is 1,100 times riskier than one day of disposing the chemical weapons. And also, the DEQ just issued the permit so Raytheon could start June the 1st on destroying the rockets at the Umatilla Chemical Depot. And
okay.
It says no air quality threat. And Henry Lorenzen, who's chairman of the DEQ committee in the state of Oregon, is one tough Jose and a very strong environmentalist and a great guy.
Okay, well,
the
Frank,
permit for a long time.
Thanks to your call. Our time is running short, but I would like Craig to comment on the remark that's been made by a couple now that it's safer to get rid of this stuff than to store it. How do you see that issue?
You might already notice that, according to Mr. Evans, it's 700 times more risky to continue to store it. According to the mayor, it's 1,100 times more risky to continue to store it.
And whatever the numbers are,
yeah.
How do you come out on the issue about whether we should get rid of it or hang on to it?
The risk assessments themselves are flawed. Even in the Army's own risk assessment at Tooele, where there is 42%, the risk is less than one fatality in a million for continued storage for 500 years, according to their own risk assessment. What they do is contort that into a comparative analysis of saying 700 times greater, 1,100 times greater, a million times greater. But the bottom line is that the risk of continued storage of these materials as a counter argument to alternative safe disposal technologies is being used as a stick to force communities to accept technologies that they would otherwise not accept, such as the burning of the most lethal chemicals on the planet in the middle of that community.
So you're not uncomfortable about hanging on to them longer, at least at this point?
There's nobody arguing to continue to store these things for 500 years or anywhere near 500 years. What we're saying is the latest information from the GAO and the Army's own Altec reports are within 5 to 7 years we can have a viable, closed-loop, non-emitting, safe, probably cheaper and more easily permitted alternative technology online, ready to go to start disposing of these weapons. That's what we're advocating.
Mary Lou Poinkins, as counsel to the Arms Control Agency, how do you find other nations have reacted to this issue? I notice a lot of countries have signed the treaty while we're still debating it. Has the notion of signing onto this been politically easier in other parts of the world? And if so, how do you account for that?
That's hard for me to assess. I can tell you're absolutely right. There are more than 170 countries that have signed and now more than 70 that have ratified. And, of course,
but I suppose a lot of those don't have chemical weapons, so maybe it's easier for them to sign up.
A lot of them don't. And I think the hesitation, certainly we, and as probably you're aware, we and the Russians have been in discussion on a bilateral basis for a long time about destruction of chemical weapons, and it's not an easy matter for them either. They're facing a very large, as you know, stockpile. I think that there is a general feeling on the part of the vast majority of nations that this will be a process that will benefit by having more participants rather than fewer. I think that if there were an appreciation of serious concerns in the United States, it might be understood that some of these time frames might have to slip a little bit.
I'm afraid you've got the last word because our time is up. We've been talking green on the Environment Show about the destruction of chemical weapons. My guests have been Mark Evans, Chief of Operations and Program Manager for Chemical Demilitarization at the Aberdeen Proving Ground, Craig Williams, co-founder of the Chemical Weapons Working Group, a citizen group, and Mary Lib Hoykins, who is General Counsel of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. We've been talking green on the Environment Show. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and let's hear from you. I'm your host, Peter Burley. Chemical weapons are an example of how tough it is to protect the environment from things we make, particularly when we don't need them anymore. Robert Hoyt's song, Quitting Time, on his album Dumpster Diving Across America, urges us to pay more attention to nature than the latest gizmo on the shelf at the gizmo store.
I used to get excited about new inventions. I'm sure most were made with the best of intentions. Thought it was cool to put a man on the moon, but now I've begun to sing a different tune. Technology and science have become a religion based on blind faith, not conscious decision. When answers cause the problems, it's time to stop and think. Slam on the brakes and make a U-turn from the brink. It's quitting time, it's quitting time. Time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time. It's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. They try to tell us how hard it used to be back when things tended towards simplicity. But our way of life is based on false pretenses. Cause look at all the unintended consequences. It's quitting time. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. Up by lies, but some of us have come see things through different eyes. Tomorrow there'll be more of us than there are today. We're that ragged, jagged, cutting edge, and we all say, it's quitting time, it's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good.
Quitting Time, from Robert Hoyt's album, Dumpster Diving Across America, on Folk in the Boat Records. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 381. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.